And then to the moment to the, he continued his generosity, and he was extremely angry and disappointed that the credit was going to his brother. And one day he got very upset, and he decided to put an end to his generosity, and he to Chai Zamzam Shashi, I'm quoting. He went and pissed in Zamzam well. Once he did that, the whole world started talking about him and not about his brother anymore. And now Imam to Chai Zamzam Shashi did. Hostage taking is exactly like pissing in Zamzam well, and that's exactly what Imam has done. He knows it is bad, but he says the whole world is talking about us.
This is what
Muntazir is.
Now, who is the brother, though?
Nothing. There was no brother or not. He was trying to explain the nature of the act of the second brother. Maybe even in the beginning, I would say it was Khomeini himself that initially, which is really in a sense, at least from this standpoint, that the first time when the hostage taking took place in Iran, it was Khomeini who intervened and put an end to it through Yazdi, and William Sullivan has written about it, you know, in his book. Anyway, well, that wasn't really the important point. Was the second point, and I laughed and said, "He said, well, I said, well, would it be possible for you to support this idea when we go to home?" He said, "Yes, I do my best." So we went home. The first person who was going to say something to Khomeini was sitting here. It really was the seating arrangement with respect to Muntazir and his position was also interesting. The wall was here. Khomeini was sitting here. He was not leaning against the wall. Muntazir was sitting on his right hand side, further back, leaning against the wall. And a number of people, several people, the ones I remember very distinctly was Muinfar, Qutzadeh, myself, Nasser Makarem Shirazi, for some reason he was also in the room, Ahmad Khomeini, and a couple of other mullahs, younger people. Khomeini's grandson, what was his name? Anyway, the younger one. They were all sitting here. The first person who talked was Muinfar, which was another fascinating, revealing encounter. Muinfar said, you know, since the hostage crisis began, our oil export has really suffered, and we cannot export enough oil because of the boycott, and our export, the total volume of export, has actually come under 2 million barrels a day, which is a real, you know, reduction. But in order to present a strong position to the rest of the world, in our announcements and in our publicity, we say that the oil export is 2.5 million. Khomeini listened to that story, and here is Minister of Oil informing the chief about the reality and the political, the propaganda aspect of the claim. And Khomeini listened and said, put the word approximately before 2.5 million, so you wouldn't have any religious difficulty in pronouncing. In fact, he said, یک کلمه تقریبا جلوی 2.5 million بگذارید که از نظر شرعی اشکالی نداشته باشه. And I'm quoting him verbatim. Which was kind of interesting and revealed. And then it was my turn, and he, you know, he wouldn't listen. I had met him several times, four times actually, in Paris. So this was the first time that I was meeting him in Tehran. So I know that he has no patience to listen to long the presentations or discussions. So I had practiced and memorized literally every word I was uttering before him. And I said, I have about maybe 5 minutes at the most, and I want to say everything possible about this interview. So I presented my argument to him that hostage taking is devastating us economically and damaging our revolution morally, causing a great deal of hardship for Iranians abroad. We have already proven our case, and continuation of this thing could only be destructive, you know, from the standpoint of national interest and the Iranian society. That everybody is familiar with those arguments. His response initially was that, oh, he confirmed what Montazeri had said in that anecdote, in a sense. He said, you know, if another point that I made, in fact, I showed him some examples. So as a result of this, our revolution is getting a great deal of negative publicity and commentary, and the labeling of really derogatory and immoral nature, and we should put an end to this. He said, you know, if once the hostages are released, they will not write anything about us anymore. Instinctively, he was, in a sense, almost a postmodern politician, of saying that publicity, being in the limelight, is important regardless of what they say about us. You know, this is the kind of position that the political packaging firms in Washington and New York take. You know. But the important thing is to be in the news. Anyway, but basically that was his. Nevertheless, after, you know, continuation, even in the conversation, he got the kind of irritated and said, oh, inka hafa Amerika, yes. That the security of the country would be endangered as a result of the weakening of our armed forces and military, which was a real concern for the people who know it. I specifically mentioned Iraq, you know, that here there is a threat to our territorial integrity and the continuation of the weakening of Iranian defense forces. And when he said, he got very angry, said, oh, that's half Amrika, that's something that Americans would say, you people have lived abroad. And he took one look at me and he knew that he was not talking to an Islamic type. You know, you opened your mouth, and even my hair, I had very, you know, long, even though I had beard, but he didn't know that my beard was from the anti-war movement of the 1960s. And not from, but he knew he was extremely sharp when it came to recognizing and understanding people. And his description, you know, this is not the kind of argument that we submit to and all that, but nevertheless, as it, you know, the discussion went on for about half an hour, which was very unusual for Khomeini.
Were other people participating,
you know. As we were discussing this, Khomeini, Montazeri once, Khomeini said, yes, if the International Commission comes and condemned American interference in Iran, then we would accept the recommendation and Majlis would respond to that. And I said, well, their recommendation would be inevitably to release the hostages. Yeah, there is no question about that. Even if they gave us a condemnation of American foreign policy, that would be completely pleasing to us. Still, that suggestion. He said, fine, the Majlis would respond. At this moment, Montazeri interfered and said, but that would take too long. That's the reason I was describing. And here, Khomeini was saying, he took his right hand out of his abba and said, Shoma be kar khodetun berisi. You know, that, shut up. You know, and at that, I did not know. At that moment, I realized that this guy really doesn't have any respect for him. And Montazeri didn't say another word for the rest of the time we were there. Moin Fad, Makarem Shirazi were very supportive. And Qutbzadeh, obviously, again, Qutbzadeh was supportive. Again, he had his own agenda. He also was running for the presidency and all that, and he wanted to score a big, you know, victory and be an international figure, and of course the resolution of the hostage crisis would have helped him with his agenda, because opposition to the release of the hostages had other contenders who could, he could never compete with them. The clear, unmistakable impression Khomeini gave us that if this such a commission produces a report that satisfies us, we will release the hostages. So with that solid understanding, I left home and came to New York. At that time, I had so much admiration for him still. It was the beginning of the waning of the admiration. But it wasn't, you know, a love affair doesn't end abruptly if it's genuine. And my respect and love for Khomeini was very genuine and deeply felt. Not because I identified with him as a leader or as a culture or political figure, but as a grandfather figure who wanted to re-establish our nativity. Even as it was the beginning of it, but initially I never saw him as a political leader. It was just unimaginable for me, as well as, and if you ask me even for Khomeini himself, that he would be the head of the state appointing the police chief and the military chief and all that. I don't think he had that agenda. He always saw himself in the beginning as a source of moral influence on the political order and not the chief of the state as the top executive officer of the political order. So it was, and this is December 79 and you know, a month and a half and all that into the hostage taking. So the love and respect was weakening. And these examples, for example, that particular day was a very important day for me because that response he gave to Mouin Fall about the oil was, you know, I didn't expect him to say that. You know. Or I didn't expect Montazeri to describe Khomeini's motives and behavior with respect to hostage taking as, you know, he did. Or I didn't expect him to behave toward Montazeri the way he did. He was very different in Paris. Not that he was acting out. In Paris, he had no army, he had no police chief, he was a genuine, real religious figure. He was a man without substantive power. His power was completely on the moral level and ideological level where people simply admired him. By this time, he had become the de facto head of a state. And all conflicts in Iranian society went to him. And the reason he was transformed into that position is also a very important subject of investigation about which virtually nothing has been written. Khomeini went to Qom. And he appointed Bazargan and gave Bazargan complete freedom to choose his cabinet members. Yeah. And when Bazargan complained about performance of Khodzadeh in radio and television, Khomeini told him, "Well, you are the prime minister, fire him." Yeah. Here, on this governmental side as well as the political side of Barry's group, conflicts were reaching an ever-expanding and intense kind of level, and every time the conflict had to be resolved in order for government to function, they went to Khomeini. So they involved, you know, in the failure of the secular liberal forces and the utter failure of the leftist forces to understand this, the utter failure of the liberal forces to see the importance and the crucial nature of the sourcing to get involved, and they continue to moan and groan and bitch about everything, as is, you know, the primary attribute of Iranian liberalism, just moan and groan, you know, regardless of, you know, with a purposeless kind of pomposity about everything. So in the context of this, and then decisions have to be made, you know, whether it's about a position, about policy, about whether or not an institution has to be established, and all that. So they go to him. So he resolves the conflict. So they drew him in, and the more they drew him in, the more and rapidly they transformed him. And when I say they, I don't mean sitting and making systematic decisions. Just the dynamics of the situation and the political incompetence and immaturity of us all. And
I think that happened to the
show. Sure, I'm sure you can. Except that this one, I'm speaking of it as a witness, I'm sure you know about that. So they gradually, the revolutionary forces collectively made a heavy contribution to Ayatollah Khomeini becoming a megalomaniac. And, you know, even a 75-year-old man had the potential to go through the transformation. Of course, there was a fertile ground, but I would say that all people who get involved in politics, particularly politics of the Third World, have that potential to one degree or another. The whole idea of looking for purity, for the right and perfect man, that's a kind of absurdity that is not really a political orientation.
But
well, it's when we go and read and all that, it's the kind of religious structure. He never saw himself being. He said, "This is the way the government ought to." But that's the way the left wrote about government. That's the way Shah wrote about government, and the liberals wrote about government to the extent that they did. They thought, you know, other people should do it, and their job is just to reap the fruits or be moral critics on the margins. And, but the people who wrote about government in Iran, they all wrote in such harsh, absolutist, one-dimensional fashion. The way we talked about government, you know, including the way we talked about government before I became a student of politics and studied books and became a teacher. There were correct decisions and right decisions that the government had to be made. That the notion that there is no such a thing as truth with capital T in government and all that was an alien notion. So when perhaps Khomeini's vocabulary and symbolism is somewhat, you know, strange or unacceptable to the leftist, liberals and secularists in general, but I don't think in substance and in content he wrote about government in a different way than other political groups or personalities did. Yeah. Now retroactively going back and isolating something and bringing it out and all that is of course easy to do. We could do that about... I don't think that is really a way of so what happens in action and behavior. If that's the way he felt, why didn't he appoint someone like Beheshti to the premiership right after the revolution? Why didn't he take more direct control of significant appointments in whether domestic policy or foreign policy? He did nothing of that nature at all. He genuinely and really gave Bazargan the leeway. And let me go even further than that with respect to showing that his behavior, what we as human beings do in the specific situations, is far more important than abstract ideas we present in as thinkers. When the first draft of the Iranian constitution was written, which was written by liberals, Khomeini was opposed to the establishment of the Constituent Assembly to ratify it. And his opposition was that he thought it takes too long, and he was somewhat afraid of instability, an absence of institutionalization. He wanted to speed things up. On the margin of that constitution, which is in the prison, he said, Belamane asked, a couple places. One was on the question of women and whether or not a woman could be the president. That was one issue he objected to. And he didn't really have much difficulty selling that even to the most liberal members of the left and all that. I mean, it's, as you well know, much better than I do. That wasn't an issue for the vast majority of political forces and personalities in Iran. the principled, and at the time including myself, the necessary demand for establishment of a constituent assembly came from the left and the liberals. Someone like Rafsanjani, I have quoted him in an article, he said to Barisat once, who do you think would be elected to the constituent assembly? Yek mosh ahund nafahm. That's exactly what he said. Yek mosh ahund nafahm. Who would change this constitution in such a degree that you wouldn't be able to recognize it. So the demand finally forced Khomeini to accept the idea, and then they had to compromise, and every single day that passed convinced the clerical elements of their power in Iran. Time was very much on their side in recognizing what a massive mobilizing capability they had. The idea of Majlis-e Khebregan or Constituent Assembly was a compromise idea coming from Ayatollah Taleghani, who said, well, you people want to establish an assembly for 200 members, constituent assembly, and Ayatollah Khomeini says, we don't need it right now. And he said, the first Majlis should have the mandate to make any kind of revisions in the constitution that they deem necessary. Yeah. Which was an idea, kind of combining the first Majlis with the constituent assembly. So they reached this conclusion, this compromise, and they accepted it. And when the campaign began for election to the constituent assembly, I hate to admit this, but I think that was a reasonably free election in Iran. Except that when people in Yazd wanted to elect a member to the constituent assembly, whom do they elect? They have been mobilized for a year of demonstrations, and the leader, unquestioned and unchallenged leader of the demonstration in Yazd, was Ayatollah Saduri. In fact, Ayatollah Saduri was so popular that even before the revolution, he was a personality. So Ayatollah Madani in Tabriz, Ayatollah this, Ayatollah Dasri in Shiraz. So the leaders, there was no other leadership. The left and the liberals and all that, we were all limited to northern part of our cities, and people like ourselves with very little contact with the general population. If the general population was going to be mobilized at the time, and there was competition between religious figures and the liberals or the leftists for the support and loyalty of the people, there wasn't much of a contest. The vast majority of the liberals and leftists could not even communicate with the country. Now, if they were not mobilized and politics remained in the realm of the middle class, as the politics of Mossadegh period, masses of Mossadegh had nothing to do, then within that limited constituency of middle class, which is really the normal business of politics in the vast, in most countries, including the Western world, there the liberal leftists could have a very disproportionate impact on the political outcome and political process because of their capabilities as individuals and organizations, and not because they had numerical support and numbers. But at that particular time, the country was mobilized, and elections were being propagated as an important mobilizing and galvanizing method, and they won. They won. I'm not saying that we should be, it was free in the sense of all political forces being able to, they were present, and it was as free as anything we have ever had in the Third World. And these people were genuinely really elected. There was no shenanigan involved. And only in Tehran, some individuals like Bazargan, Taleghani, or in Tabriz, somebody like, who was his name from, anyway, half a dozen liberals, secularists, half a dozen, 10 of them were elected, the rest overwhelming the situation. So I'm talking about the processes that gradually transformed a lot of these people. Now, once they were transformed, the ideas they had of course, they were not opposed to the hardline fundamentalist chemistry. Anyway, when you say I don't, we kind of deviated from. So I returned, I came to New York, and this is the other dimension of this whole political process. I came to New York. I started working on this commission, contacted with Waldheim regularly, who was one of the least exciting human beings I've ever met in my life. Very bureaucratic, uncreative, intellectually dumb and bankrupt. You know, I go to him and I say, you know, yes, I am the representative of Iran. Yes, I am the ambassador and all that. But right now, Iran is not a country where an ambassador is representing them. There is no government in Iran in the sense of representing the interests of it. There are people in nominal positions of authority, and there are people who have the real power. Some people are desperately interested in solving this crisis. Others don't want to solve it. And they are both very important and powerful. I represent those elements who desperately want to solve this. They're kind of working with him with complicity. He responds to me as if this is a new strategy, this is another diplomatic strategy. And I also tell him that I'm not a diplomat, I've been an academician all my life and all that. This is the first time that, like many other people in Iran, we are thrown into a situation. I soon realize that the man is just an uninteresting, dumb wall. So I went to the Algerian ambassador, whom I knew through Richard Falk, Mohammed Bejawi, and asked him to take an active part, and he understood me. And I said, Algeria is the country that is highly respected in Iran. And if you are the chairman of this commission, it would be very beneficial to the people in Iran who want to solve this problem. He understood it, and he was very active. And there, another member of the commission was Syria. And these were other things that I was trying to explain to Waldheim, that members of this commission symbolically are very important. On January 7, 1980, in the Security Council, Waldheim presented the idea to the Security Council. We had already done, I came to New York on December 17th. So we had done some work on this, and preliminary. At that stage, the United States opposed the idea. Of the commission. And the reason they opposed the idea was because Kennedy was portraying Carter in the New Hampshire primary campaign as soft on the Ayatollah. And the White House people, they were completely absorbed with Kennedy's challenge to Carter's renomination. And the polls were indicating that he was many points ahead. So Carter during that period took a very kind of decisive anti-compromise in the position because they thought in his political, his campaign team this, had thought that this is the best way to eliminate the case. So the hostage, the resolution of the hostage taking itself became subservient to the campaign. This was the time that I called McHenry through Ambassador Qaisar, who was Bangladesh ambassador. I talked to him. He came to my dinner. I talked to him. I said, I wish the Americans accept this right away, because in Iran, every single day is pregnant with new events. We don't know if we wait 2 months. And still, I'm not certain that Khomeini would have accepted it. But the chances are, you know, the if is history is a very big if. But I would say if Americans had accepted the commission in early January, the first meeting Waldheim, the Security Council meeting Waldheim requested it, and the commission had been sent to Iran immediately, I think the chances would have been much better to resolve it. Even the second time Khomeini went through, it was a very excruciating kind of experience. So they rejected it. And Khomeini apparently in Iran, I never saw him after that, but he said, I told you so, that Americans are not going to submit to our request and the commission, you know, and all that. He interpreted it differently, completely oblivious to why, you know, because for me being you know, a creature of both cultures. I knew that politics was really at the core of American business. So I talked to McHenry on the phone, and I explained to him, again in the same way more or less I explained to Walton, that this is not a situation that you're dealing with a negotiator from the other side, that you're dealing with the well-established government. The government, the nominal government in Iran, is more desperate to solve this problem, because hostage crisis in Iran was really was degrading and demoralizing the secular liberal forces. The left was absolutely demolished as a result of it, and the liberals were passive and inactive and all that. He said, you know, he responded again like a diplomat, and he said, well, I will take the issue to Washington and discuss it with them in the National Security Council. But then this was the second. Well, the second time around, after the New Hampshire primary was over, then this time the United States presented the proposal to the Security Council. And Khomeini's response this time was very lukewarm. But the commission members were already formed and we were waiting, and I was absolutely certain that once the primary is over, the commission is going to be formed. And Vaughan was very much aware of that, and he told me the same thing. So the commission went to Iran in early March. They were supposed to be there originally for 5 days. Khomeini made them wait in Iran for 17 days. I don't know, you know, it's everything. And he finally said no.